When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Coming up on the episode today, Michael Wolff has been writing about Donald Trump for, 4 years now? You may remember his first book, Fire and Fury, was the one that prompted Donald Trump to insist he was a very stable genius. Then he wrote Siege, which took us into the dark depths of the middle of the presidency. Well, he's got a new book out. It's called Landslide, and it chronicles the final days of Donald Trump's presidency and that extraordinary moment, the march on the Capitol. And in a strange twist, given how much they fell out at the beginning, Michael Wolff ended up sitting down with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. So I've got an interview with Michael Wolff coming up on the episode. It's a properly fascinating listen, if slightly terrifying. But first is the columnist panel. It's Thursday, so it must be night at the Marriott. It's India Knight and James Marriott. So let's talk about our favourite food and how the government is going to try and take it off of us, apparently. This review from Henry Dimbleby calling for a sugar and salt tax to try and divert us all into eating better food. India, will this work? How many times are we told that we need to eat? Is it a problem that we don't know that we shouldn't be eating this stuff, or there are other forces at work?
I think the main force at work in terms of sugar, certainly salt, I think, is more to do with junk food and ready meals. The problem with sugar is that we associate it with rewards and treats. And this starts really, really, really early in childhood. You know, you've been a good boy, have a sweetie. And that link, once that link is made, it's very difficult to break. And I think if we could somehow get to the point where sweet things and puddings and pastries and chocolate bars weren't a form of rewarding ourselves, then we would have a much kind of saner relationship with them. So I think the kind of psychological aspect of it needs to be taken into account, because without it, you will never get away from the fact that people have sweet teeth. That sounds weird, sweet teeth, sweet tooths. And that kind of sugar craving is very, very hard to kick. I think, you know, sugar is addictive. It's kind of an addiction, sugar. So just kind of banning people outright or making it more difficult or more expensive, which will, of course, disproportionately affect poorer people who are fatter generally, is kind of three quarters right. But there needs to be extra stuff on top. And also, this report doesn't mention the very fattening effect of refined carbohydrates, i.e. white stodge, which turns into stodge on your body, basically.
James, what did you think about that? Because I was sort of thinking about it's partly reward. So if something's gone, I mean, I'm basically thinking of my own eating habits. If something's gone well, you sort of reward yourself with a drink or a nice meal. If something's gone badly, you commiserate yourself with some wine and a nice meal. If you're very tired, then you probably want to do nothing more than just have some wine and a nice meal. So you could basically find a reason to justify eating badly all the time. That's basically what I do.
I think so, yeah. Well, I mean, I have actually, my personal diet strategy, if listeners of Times Radio are interested, they maybe not, is Friday's treat day. So Friday is my day for filled pasta. If I eat as much filled pasta on Friday as I can, then I think that sort of seems to...
Is that it? What, like fresh pasta? You know,
I'm obsessed with it. It's like my favourite
food. And that's your treat on a Friday?
Yeah. It's really nice.
I wouldn't call filled pasta a sort of filthy vice to be indulged in.
Oh, it is. It's really bad.
Do you eat it while you're in the bath?
No, but that's a wonderful idea, and I think I probably will this Friday. Next time there's a big football match, I'm going to sit in the bath with my filled pasta, dead to the world.
A terrifying mental image for listeners.
No, but I just wanted to say that I think I sort of disagree with India a bit, because I think the obesity crisis, I think the thing we have to grasp about it is that I don't think it's a matter of personal psychology or willpower. I think it is this kind of structural problem. And I think this report sounds great. I mean, it's very... It was very Jamesy, and it's like sort of big ideasiness. It'll always get a bit overexcited by these things. I love the ideas of robots in fields picking weeds, and completely behind the idea of a sugar tax. And I think this is probably the only way to fix the problem. And I think we'd be amazed at the effect that those structural changes can have. And I also think the sort of interesting stuff reading around it, the fact that childhood obesity, although it's stable, that stability is because it's increasing in poor children but reducing in rich children, means that evidently we have this evidence that there are that the obesity crisis is something, it's not this inevitable progress. There are clearly people doing things to reduce it, and maybe it'll just take this sort of big government intervention to end it, because it is crazy. It's is it the majority of adults are now overweight, and sort of is it 3 in 10 are obese or something? These are just absolutely, you know, this is just like unprecedented in human history. And I think the scale of these plans is completely, you know, it's completely kind of commensurate to the problem.
And it seems, India, as if the government is having another one of its sort of contortions as to where, you know, where its ideological position lies. In that they're now suddenly coming over all libertarian again. You know, George Eustace saying he will carefully consider the conclusions and respond with a white paper within 6 months, which doesn't feel like they're grasping it too tightly. Robert Jenrick was very much playing it down this morning on Times Radio, saying you have to think carefully before you approach policies like that. And, you know, so you go back to the old libertarian argument, leaving people to do what they want, you know, but then we're also having an argument about face masks, and, you know, the government has been telling us about exactly how to live our lives, right down to when we can leave the house and what is and isn't a necessary journey and all that sort of thing. So this is a government which has been willing, in the name of public health, to take quite an interventionist approach, but doesn't seem to want to do it on this.
Well, no, because you can see how wildly unpopular these proposals would be with various sections of society, and they're the sections of society that always get it in the neck. You know, it reminds me of people with giant tellies, people sneering at poorer families with giant tellies. And actually, the reason they've got a giant telly is because a giant telly is their only entertainment. So, you know, you can argue that the reason people go to the chippy and buy cans of giant 2 litre bottles of fluorescent fizzy drinks and give their children chocolate bars is that because there isn't anything else very nice going on in their lives. So it's really hard. And those are the people, particularly in the north, who, you know, are new converts to Boris Johnson. So it's a very kind of delicate thing. It's all very well to say in a middle class way, everybody should eat brown rice and miso and organic eggs. But, you know, and also, of course, there's the question of cookery lessons, which I think really are really, really important and ought to come into it. And the idea that, you know, anything to do with cookery, domestic science, feeding yourself is kind of a silly side subject. And, you know, on Friday we make scones and take them home. I mean, children need to be taught properly how to be able to feed themselves. It's a really kind of basic thing. And I think the shunting, I mean, they do exist again, cookery lessons in schools, since about 2014, but the shunting to the side of them for at least one generation was a disaster, because people literally can't feed themselves and they're tired, they've been working, they get home, they want something to eat that's going to be instantly satisfying or fill a craving. And so they eat rubbish. But, you know, you can't entirely blame them and you can't entirely penalise them. You need to be a bit clever about it. But generally, I think the recommendations are great. But then I would say that because I'm not the people I've just described.
And I think, well, there's also an interesting point, which I think was being made on Times Radio Breakfast this morning, is that on the one hand, they want the tax. Basically, the idea is you want the companies to reformulate the food that they make, or they have to pay the tax. And then he's hypothecating the tax would go to sport and all that sort of thing. But if the companies reformulate, you don't get any of the money. So it's not totally, because what we've seen with a lot of fizzy drinks is when they brought in the, when George Osborne brought in the sugar tax on fizzy drinks, lots of them did just take the sugar out of their of their drinks. I think there was a big rant about, was it Iron Brew? People said it didn't People said it didn't taste the same. Anyway, let's not get bogged down in that, because the last time I mentioned something on air a lot, somebody sent us a box of Twixes, which I only treat myself and have one on a Friday, James, like you, but not in the bath. James, I want to talk about the column that you've written today about how you think the binds that the ties that bind us are breaking down.
Yes, I do. This, I guess, is another sort of thing, another sort of problem that I sort of think is that people talk a lot about the loneliness epidemic, and I guess like the obesity epidemic, I think it's something we tend to think of as sort of a personal individual problem, but is actually a sort of structural problem in society. And the basic argument of my column was that the idea of a loneliness epidemic makes us think of this sort of thing passing through society, but actually, I think these amazing statistics about loneliness that were reported last week by the think tank Onward, I think the number of young people saying they have either one or fewer than one close friends has tripled in the last decade. Trust in strangers is declining. Trust in family is declining. These things aren't this sort of isolated phenomenon that's just suddenly arrived. I think they're quite deeply rooted in the way society is structured and the history of society. So one of the things I was mentioning in the column, which I think is a crucial part of the loneliness epidemic, is how mobile the population of our country and most Western countries is. We take it for granted that we'll move around for jobs, we'll move cities. It's quite normal in the UK and America. It's almost a rite of passage that you'll move away for university. 80% of students in the UK move away for university. Moving to a new place is basically one of the most important predictors of social disconnection. You sort of wipe all your social networks and you start over again. There are studies that show that when you move country, immigrants who move to another country never recover the same depth and complexity of social networks. And I think that's just one thing that's a feature of our society, and it's part of how society works, that I don't know that we'd necessarily want to lose. It's a sort of freedom that, you know, gives rise to enormous loneliness. And sorry, just one other thing on that point is I was speaking to Oxford anthropologist Robin Dunbar, who's an expert on friendship. And he says that he thinks a lot of what's picked up by these sort of surveys of loneliness is the misery of isolated elderly people. And then the other end, isolated young people who have moved away from home for the first time to new cities to find jobs. And I guess that's just, you know, that's just part of the fact that we probably want to move to cities to move jobs. That's a great freedom to have, but it's just part of the way our society is structured that makes us lonely. And I think a lot of these kind of, you know, the idea of a loneliness epidemic maybe reduces the problem a bit and doesn't acknowledge how deeply rooted it is in the way that we live, basically.
And what do you think about this? I've thought for a while that social media, actually, it's quite good at keeping you in touch with people that you know. But in fact, there was a story yesterday or the day before about how people were using dating apps to meet new friends. But it's not a very good way of meeting new people. And I know from having seen this with sort of teenagers that I know, you know, they have this very sort of close-knit group of friends who are all in the same WhatsApp or Snapchat group or whatever, but they don't sort of, they don't particularly go out and socialise. They don't drink as much, they go out as much. But as a result, you don't meet any new people. You can still keep having that chat in your social media groups, but you're not meeting a friend of a friend in a bar or a club or whatever it might be.
So I think I think that's the absolutely crucial thing, and it's the thing I wished I'd been able to get into my column, because talking again to this guy Robin Dunbar.
We're doing it again. We're rewriting your column live on air.
I know. I wish you'd stop doing this to me. Maybe we should do this the day before my column.
That would make more sense.
Go and write it after this.
Yeah.
He was saying the basic problem with social media is that basically, as a forming social connections as a human is this like enormously complex thing. He spent his career studying this, and he says it takes, you know, just tens and tens and tens and tens and thousands of hours of practice to become a normally functioning social human being. He says most people achieve that about the age of 25. I think I'm still waiting, but basically, the more time you spend away on your phone, you're just not developing any of those, that vast panoply of social skills that you need to navigate. I mean, he says, you know, human social networks are the sort of most complicated thing in the universe. And the more we take huge swathes of practice out of enjoying those things and interacting with them, you know, that's the, he thinks that's the main damage of screens and social media, basically, which is kind of what you said.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting. What do you think, Idia?
I think everything has become so complicated. I mean, you see, I agree completely about social media. Social media creates these completely synthetic intimacies that people really are emotionally invested in and believe in, and believe that these are proper, nourishing, serious, strong friendships. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they aren't really. And as you say, meeting a friend of a friend in a pub or whatever is likely, is much more fulfilling, I think. And I think also in terms of relationships, you know, I'm constantly amazed and saddened by how complicated younger people find having relationships with people of partner relationships. I mean, not friend relationships. That also seems to have become really, really just such a complicated tangle. And I think that is because people know so few people in real life that when you are looking for a partner, you're not, whereas, I don't know, 50 years ago, even 10 years ago, actually, you'd have just been looking for a partner to be a partner. You're now looking for the partner to be everything, to play the role of about 6 people, to be your best friend and to be like a really great colleague and to be your lover and to be quite parental and to be, you know, so it's all jumbled up. And so relationships are a mess and people find them difficult. It makes me really glad that I'm old.
And doing the crossword, India.
Like an old person, but doing the crossword.
To be clear, I'm not calling you old. I just want to be absolutely clear. For the benefit of the tape, I'm not calling you old. That was entirely your
I don't mind being called but old.
Let's talk about just quickly about crosswords and how we might live longer if we do the Times Cryptic crossword.
I've been doing various, any kind of word game for years and years and years, and the absolute conviction that it's going to save me from Alzheimer's, which my father developed and which was just the most horrendous thing ever. So now there's a yet another piece of research out of a university in Chicago, which says that keeping your brain active, crosswords being a really brilliant example, it's not necessarily going to stave off Alzheimer's, but it means that your brain will deteriorate more slowly and keep ticking over properly for longer. So, yeah, word games, marvellous.
You're a big word game fan?
No, I always think crosswords should be my thing, but I think I'm too stupid to do them. I've gotten to Sudokus and Tetris are my two. Didn't Tetris improve your memory? Probably not.
I've been to a stage of doing Sudoku on a train into work. The Independent might have been the first ones to start sort of really running Sudokus.
Was it the Times? I think the Sudokus might be a Times.
Well, I was reading the Independent at the time. I think it was around the time the Times turned me down for the graduate trainee scheme, and I refused to have anything to do with them. They're a bit samey, aren't they, Sudokus? I mean,
it is the same numbers every week in a load of squares, but
mix it up with some different numbers. Anyway, it's lovely to speak to you as ever. India, get back to your crossword. And James, run yourself a deep bath and fill it with pasta or whatever it is you're planning to do for the evening. India Knight and James Marrett there. Of course, you can read them both in the Times and the Sunday Times. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is my interview with Michael Wolff.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, it's time for my interview with the author, Michael Wolff.
I'm a very stable genius.
So, Michael Wolff, I sort of want to start at the end, really, because it's the end of the book, and it's also the thing that I understand the least in a book, which is almost beyond comprehension at times, not because of the way you've written it, but because of the character that you're chronicling. How do you end up? There's a third book that you've written on Donald Trump. The first time he threatened to sue you and said you're a total loser who made up stories in order to sell this really boring and untruthful book. And by the end of the third book, you're sitting in Mar-a-Lago chewing the fat with him. How on earth does that happen? Explain how that happens and what that tells us about the man, Donald Trump.
You know, I can't explain the logic of this, but I can explain the sequence. I had a number of people around the president who I have been speaking to, well, since the first book, knew I was planning this third book, and they told him. But when he was told, then as the story was related to me, he said the following. He said, "That guy gets ratings. Let's see him." So I was immediately invited to come to Mar-a-Lago to see the former president and to sit down with him, interview him as long as I wanted. And then, in fact, to have dinner with him. So I found myself in March in Mar-a-Lago as surprised as anybody.
I suppose in a normal situation, if you're writing a book about a senior politician, getting time with that senior politician as a sort of first-hand witness would be that's striking gold, if you like, rather than piecing it together from those around them. But how reliable a witness is Donald Trump to the events of Donald Trump?
He is the most unreliable witness there could possibly be. For a host of reasons, including that he's an inveterate liar, but even beyond that, and I think more importantly, he lives in his own reality. So he's constantly construing reality to his needs, without relevance to external empirical facts and data.
There's a really interesting bit in the first chapter in the book where you talk about how normal professional politicians, observers of politics, journalists, sometimes to try and make sense of Donald Trump, project onto him logic, strategy, a plan, because that's what you think happens in politics, that clever people do clever things.
Yeah, well, even if you're a bad guy.
They might be bad at doing it, or they might be pursuing bad ends, but there's a plan,
but they're all politicians, and politics is ultimately about cause and effect, and everybody or most everybody funnels Donald Trump into that framework, that logical framework.
And your argument is we're wrong to do that, and part of the reason why we do that is because we don't like to think possibly that somebody who's just crazy ends up as the president of the United States of America.
But in point of fact, someone who is just crazy, not just crazy, grandly crazy, absolutely deranged, has ended up as the president of the United States. And someone without interest in politics, policy, government, management. So any of the disciplines, we essentially credit Donald Trump with having or being interested in. None of that is true. He is interested only in the adulation of the crowd and the sound of his own voice.
And the picture you paint of people who sort of come in and out of his orbit, some of them quite smart people, and they get quite close and they think, wow, I'm not having anything to do with this. I'm going to go back to
you know, my job. And so as a result, the clever ones get in and then get out. And the ones who stay, you end, at one point, it was described as like the Star Wars canteen bar, where it's just a sort of collection of oddballs still hanging out in the Oval Office. If you've watched The West Wing, or even, frankly, Veep, you get an idea of sort of smart people going from room to room and doing stuff. Paint the picture of what's really going on in the Donald Trump Oval Office as you...
Well, yeah, it. I mean... you know, I think, and there's a story early in the book about Karl Rove, and the president has gotten some weird idea in his head, sort of rather late in the campaign, which was that the Democrats are not going to nominate Joe Biden. They're going to replace Joe Biden with Andrew Cuomo and Michelle Obama. And so Trump is in a big kerfluffle about this, because he's scared against running against these people. And among the things he won't do, he won't attack Joe Biden. Everybody in the campaign is like, well, what do you mean? We gotta make a move here. We got to attack this guy. We're going to be running against him. He won't do it. So they call in the ultimate strategist in the Republican Party, Karl Rove. And in fact, this is during the pandemic, and Rove is in Texas, and he's saying, "Well, I don't want to come to Washington." But they beg him, "No, the president needs you. The party needs you. We need you to sit down with the president and tell him that this is crazy. I mean, you know, this is a super secret meeting. We need you to do this." So Rove comes to Washington, walks into the Oval Office, and there are 15 people there. Rove, who spent 8 years, you know, within a few inches of the Oval Office, who understands that what happens in the Oval Office, this is the pinnacle of seriousness in government. And he thinks, who are these people? He doesn't even know what they're doing there. And that's basically the Oval Office at any given time. People coming and going, hanging out. Everybody is invited, not least of all because Trump can't be alone.
He just has to have people. Crucially, he just seems to just want people there who will listen to him. That's the main purpose. If anyone
else, yes, I mean, clearly he is never listening to anyone else. Never. So it's just the sound of his own voice. Reality in this White House is very circumscribed, and it takes place only within the sound of his own voice.
Obviously, the background to the election campaign was the pandemic. Trump got very well. He caught coronavirus himself and was ill, but then lots of people around him were ill too.
The White House was as dangerous as a nursing home.
Wow! And what impact did that have?
Essentially, almost everybody got it, and then they were always blaming someone else for giving it to them, including Trump, who blamed Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, for giving him COVID.
And what impact did that have on an already dysfunctional situation? In a time when actually you really want government to step up, you already had a dysfunctional government of just oddballs hanging out in the Oval Office, and then suddenly COVID rips through it. What was going on behind the scenes during that period?
It's catastrophic. It was obviously catastrophic for the management of the pandemic, but it was also catastrophic for Trump's reelection campaign. Probably one of the most haphazard, capricious, and incompetent campaigns that a sitting president has ever run. You know, and certainly that was part of the issue. Everybody got sick. But on top of that, it was the even overriding issue is that the president is the ultimate decider about everything, and he's a complete incompetent.
And at one point, he even suggested using the pandemic as an excuse to indefinitely postpone the election.
Actually, on two occasions that I know of, he proposed this, to be met by incredulity of his aides and cohorts.
I suppose that there's something for that. And so then we sort of moved through to the actual election night. There's a party in full swing in the White House, because obviously if you're still in the Trump camp, you think you're going to win because he wins everything. And then it suddenly turns when they realize that isn't what's happening. But nobody obviously wants to tell him.
Yeah, no, I mean, for the better part of a week, they basically try not to tell him. I mean, you cannot go to Donald Trump with bad news. He just doesn't accept it. When they ultimately did go, and there's a delegation. So the election is on Tuesday, the 3rd. On Saturday, the 7th, there's a delegation that goes to tell him he's lost the election and he has to concede. And it's a funny gathering with everybody sort of pushing the other ahead, you know, out in front, so that they'll that they have to deliver the news. And one of the guys who delivers the news, and they're supposed to say, you know, you cannot, it's over, it's done with. And then they anticipate him saying, what do you, what's our plan? And then they said, going to say, well, you have to concede. So that's what they go in thinking. But the guy who then is sort of pushed ahead to deliver the news kind of punts. And he doesn't say, you've lost. He says, there's less than a 5% chance that you can win. At which point, Donald Trump, who construes numbers in any way he wants to, says, oh, what are you talking about? 5%? There must be a 25% chance or 30% chance. So suddenly they instead of this being the off ramp, it's suddenly an on ramp to fight for this 30 or 40, and it keeps keeps growing chance that he can win the election. So that they all retreat, looking at each other, they're just dumbfounded. In his own mind, I mean, there are two givens. He cannot lose the election because he's running against Joe Biden, and it's inconceivable to him that he can lose an election to Joe Biden. Ergo, if he does lose this election, obviously it's stolen. So that night, election night, late that night, when things are have ceased to go as planned, and it looks certainly, it's unclear what's going to happen yet, but it's certainly the possibility is that he can lose. There's Rudy Giuliani there telling him, we've got to say we won, because if we don't say we won, they'll steal it. So, in fact, he goes out and he says in his rambling weirdo speech on election night,
this is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list. Okay? It's a very sad moment. To me, this is a very sad moment. And we will win this. And we, as far as I'm concerned, we already have won it. So I just want to thank you.
That now sets the stage. And when we roll into the all of the greater authorities calling this election for Joe Biden, it's a, in his mind, a stolen election.
The thing that struck me, well, two things struck me when you get to the sitting down with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. One is what a nightmare it must have been transcribing that conversation, because it's incomprehensible in large, but, you know, in terms of whole sentences that make a lot of sense, that was a, just dealing with that is quite a thing. But you also try to really press him on who has stolen the election. What is the organization? Who is the mastermind, the linchpin, the kingpin? And he doesn't really have an answer to that.
No, well, it was a funny thing, because I knew, and I basically had been told by the people around him, you know, if you go in there and challenge him and say, what do you mean the election was stolen? It's clear that it wasn't stolen. The conversation was going to end quite abruptly. So I thought about this and I thought, okay, let's just try to follow this logic out. And I was like, okay, if you won the election, how much did you win it by? And if it was stolen, that's a very complicated thing. So, you know, a lot of bad guys must have been involved with stealing it. And he agreed, yes, a lot of bad guys. And I said, who? And he said, well, I'm not going to tell you now, but I know. And when I'm ready to tell you, I'll certainly let you know.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. And what is it like when you're trying to get sense out of him? Because it is just a stream of consciousness. And one of the you know, you have just let it run in the book. So you get a real sense of, you can hear his voice as you're reading it. But when you're trying to get something useful out of him, how do you cope with a man who doesn't speak in proper sentences?
You can't. You just have to accept that all you're going to get is what comes out of his mouth, this kind of spray. And it doesn't really, frankly, matter who he's talking to. He's completely agnostic as to who is sitting in front of him. So it's whatever is on his mind at that given moment, it comes out and you just transcribe.
So let's move forwards then. So he's convinced that the election has been stolen from him. Let's move forward to January the 6th. I'm not sure Brits totally appreciate this, but January the 6th now is just the shorthand in America for what happened on the Capitol. In the way that previously dates have been, you know, it's normally terror attacks and things like that that you get. Everyone knows what that date means, the day that the Trump supporters marched on the Capitol building. Do you think he knew what he was doing when he said,
"We're going to walk down and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women"?
I do not. So I am unlike most other, certainly liberal commentators who believe he had a plan here and he was leading an insurrection. You know, what I know after having written three books, what I am absolutely sure of having written three books about Donald Trump is that there is never a plan. There is never a strategy. His mind is always in some other reality. And in fact, in this instance, at this moment, he was convinced that Mike Pence, the vice president, who has the ceremonial job of counting the electoral votes, the president believed that Mike Pence could throw out these votes and make Donald Trump the president of the United States. This was not only preposterous, but Mike Pence had told him time after time after time after time that he was not going to do this. This was not going to happen. And yet, at the same time, right up until that day, that morning, as Mike Pence began to count the votes in this ceremonial job, the president of the United States believed that that the vice president would do what had to be done so that Donald Trump and not Joe Biden would be the president installed as the president on January 20th.
There was a great line in the book where, because Trump says we're going to walk down to the Capitol, and you make the point that's not true because Donald Trump never walks anywhere. he literally in his mind doesn't walk anywhere. Those pictures were flashed around the world. America, this great democracy, having gone through this experiment of having such an unlikely character as president, then culminating in the seat of democracy being attacked in that way. What is the impact of that still in America?
It's a very, you know, a deeply polarizing event, and it becomes even more deeply polarizing because there has been a level of Trump revisionism now that's been applied to this, and it sort of mutates every day, but the effect is, oh, you know, it really wasn't that dangerous. It really wasn't that dramatic. The liberals and the Democrats have exaggerated this, when in fact it was an event that certainly no one in Washington, an event the likes of which no one in Washington had ever experienced.
Is there a sense, I wonder, that, I mean, clearly there's sort of diehard Trump supporters, which counts for a big chunk of Republican vote, though not all of it. I wonder if there's a sense of Americans that acknowledging that Trump was so flawed is an acknowledgement that your system hasn't worked. That when the moment came, America chose someone, on the basis of your three books anyway, completely ill-suited to the highest office in the land.
I guess you can also go the other way and say, you know, this is democracy. You can choose anyone you want, even someone who is totally unfit for the job. That's the beauty of democracy. Anybody, you know, that old thing, anybody could be president. Well, it turns out apparently that's true. If Donald Trump can be the president. But I, you know, I mean, having said that, no, it's an existential moment of consideration here. What does it mean that Donald Trump? Two things. What does it mean that Donald Trump could have become president? And what does it mean that a vast portion of the country not only continues to support him, but continues to regard him with awe and adulation?
What comes next then? Is there a fourth book? I mean, you know, book number four would sell well. Is that a book of him running again? Is it a book of him holed up in Mar-a-Lago, anointing all of the next generation of Trumpist Republicans? What's the next chapter of the Trump story, do you think?
Well, my existential crisis would come if I had to write a fourth book about this. I never say never, but I am done. So I hope Donald Trump is done.
What's your sense, though? I mean, it's the question that everyone wants to know the answer to, but I suspect that Trump doesn't yet know. But what's your sense? Is this a man who's ready to run again, to run the risk of not winning again, or being the martyr? Does that suit him more?
Remember, no plan, no strategy. So is it possible that he runs again? Yes, making the decision in the moment, standing before a crowd of 40,000 in a stadium, which the thing he really likes to do, which is really defines for him what being the president is. And if he stands before that crowd 2 years from now and he feels he can get a response out of the crowd by saying he's running again, might he? Well, he would certainly say then, yes, he's running again. Might he run even then? Perfectly capable of reversing himself. So, I mean, the answer is it's Donald Trump. There is no way to anticipate what's going to happen here.
The book is, reviewers and journalists like me have had it for a few days. It's been out for a couple of days. Have you had an invite back to Mar-a-Lago yet? Have you had any word back from the man himself as to what he thinks of this book?
No. His hapless spokesperson, who is in, you know, he has no real staff now. So they sort of drafted this hapless woman, seems totally shaken, came out and said it was all lies. And in fact, knowing that he would say this, I was very careful before the book came out to supply his office with essentially a list of every matter, issue of fact in the book. And they went down the list, accurate, maybe a little change here, which I changed, a dispute there, here and there, in which I made sure that I had multiple sources. But of course, Donald Trump says lies. Fake news.
Well, if it's any help, I got in touch with a couple of the people who've been in and around Donald Trump's orbit over the past few years, who I've had contact with. And one of them said that compared to the other authors, he's pretty darn accurate. I was impressed by the accuracy of much of Mr. Wolf's writing. So, you know, and that's people, you know, who describe themselves as certainly Trump cheerleaders, if not members of the team. So maybe Donald Trump sometimes says things which are not entirely accurate. Michael Wolf, it's been lovely to speak to you. Landslide, The Final Days of the Trump Presidency is out now. It's a great read, if slightly terrified.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.